This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, Episode 12, Sauce Tomate. And this is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, found online at stellaculinary.com. My name is Jacob. Thank you once again for joining me. And in this episode, we continue our five-part series. Yes, we are almost done. We have one more left to go after this show on the five French mother sauces. And today we're going to be talking about sauce tomate, which is the French version of tomato sauce. And Italians, don't hate me. I know this French did steal it from you. But it is still a one of the five French mother sauces. So it's important to understand Escoffier's take on this, only if just to put it into perspective. Doesn't mean that you ever have to make the sauce this way or even consider tomato sauce to be made in this fashion. But we need to put it into perspective, and we're going to do that today by talking about Escoffier's method for making sauce tomate, some of the possible derivatives, and then also some less complicated versions and the way that I make it. But first, we're going to talk about we're going to finish the discussion series on sauce thickeners, talking about food-grade gums, Farinier, and a couple other techniques to sort of round out the whole thickening aspect of the mother sauce series. So last episode, we got a lot into our starch thickeners, talking about flour and arrowroot and cornstarch, and we're going to kind of wrap that up and move into a couple of final, more modern thickeners, which are also known as food-grade gums. Now, one thing I want to touch on is a method that I like to use quite a lot, especially when making stews or braises, and it's referred to as Farinier, and Farinier just means flour. And so all you're doing with the Farinier technique, if you want to thicken a sauce, is you're going to preempt it by whatever you're cooking as your base is going to be dusted in flour and then seared, or more likely sautéed. So for example, if you're going to be making a beef stew and you have nice large chunks of beef that you're going to be braising down in the stew during this long cooking process, what you want to do is you want to take those chunks of beef and you first want to lightly dust them in flour, possibly seasoned with a little bit of salt and pepper. You're going to throw that into the bottom of your stew pot with some sort of fat, either butter, clarified butter, canola oil, whatever it is that you're going to be using to brown these pieces of meat. And once they're nice and brown, you're going to build your stock on top of that or your soup base. So you're going to throw in your aromatics, you're going to throw in your stock or your water, some red wine, possibly some thyme and some peppercorns. But the point being that that little bit of dusting of flour is going to influence the sauce, and it's going to release some starches into the sauce during the simmering process, which will act as a thickener. Now, I really like doing this when I am braising down either lamb shanks or when I'm braising down chicken thighs. I like to add in, you know, just either take my chicken thighs, my lamb shank, do a nice quick dusting in flour. And the flour, when it browns properly, gives you this beautiful sort of nutty aroma. And actually, it's bringing something to the party. You're not just adding it in there just as a thickener. You're adding it in there to, you know, bring that nutty aroma that comes from browned flour. And also, too, it's going to, the little bits of brown flour that sticks to the bottom of your pot after the cooking process are going to help color your braising liquid or your soup base. So when I'm doing chicken, you know, dust a little bit of seasoned flour, give it a nice sear on both sides, and really caramelize that flour. And I'll remove the chicken from the pan. I'll throw in some caramelized onions, some shallots, and I'll roast those down. And the water that's released from the onions and the shallots is going to help deglaze the flour that's been cooked onto the bottom of the pan. Add in a little bit of red or white wine, depending upon the final finished flavor profile that I'm looking for. And then make my base on top of that. And then once my base is ready to go, I'm going to throw those chicken thighs back in because they're still raw, right? I want to braise them down. It probably takes about, you know, an hour to hour and a half, depending upon the temperature of your braise and how low and slow you do it. And during that cooking period, again, the starch that's stuck to the bottom of the pan during the browning process and the starch or the flour that's still on the leg and thigh portion themselves is going to be incorporated into the sauce. And as that braising liquid slowly reduces, it's going to yield you a nice thick sauce with some body. Now, another option for thickening is completely starch-free, and this is nice if you have a gluten allergy, but also, too, it can lighten up your sauce as well, which is adding a puree. And it could be any sort of puree that you're looking for, and the finer the puree, the better the mouthfeel it's going to give. So, for example, say you wanted to thicken a veal stock, right, that's reducing down, and you don't want the heaviness of a starch thickener, but you also don't want it to reduce so far down to where you're only relying on the gelatin or the dissolved collagen to actually thicken your sauce. You can do any number of vegetable purees and mount this all minute or at the very last minute to give it its final consistency. For veal, what I recommend is something along the lines of, say, a caramelized onion puree. And you can blend this up in your blender, get it nice and smooth, even possibly pass it through a fine strainer just to ensure that smooth texture. And the last second, you're going to just swirl this puree and mix it in or whisk it into your sauce. And it's going to give you a nice, light thickness to your sauce without that heavy weightiness of a starch-thickened sauce. And this is a technique that I prefer to use in the summertime, right? In the wintertime, you want sort of those heavy, robust flavors that come from browning your roux or browning your farinier into your cooking liquid. And it gives you that nice, homey feeling that you're looking for. You know, think of Thanksgiving turkey, you know, roasted meat with that nice gravy that's made with that nice brown roux. In the summertime, you don't so much crave those things, right? Your body is in a different mode. You want something a little bit lighter, but that still doesn't mean you want a weak, thin sauce on your proteins. So it's going to, this technique will allow you to thicken your sauces using a different method, which is by using purees. And this is also a great way to thicken a soup, especially a vegetable-based soup. So if you're doing something like a carrot soup or a broccoli soup or a cauliflower soup, most of the time, you're going to cook your vegetables in your stock or in your liquid, and instead of thickening it with a starch, you're going to thicken it just by blending and pureeing. So don't underestimate or overlook the ability to puree whole products that have been cooked in a liquid to make a finished sauce. Now, sort of a hybrid version of the puree and the starch thickener is thickening with bread. Because when you add bread to your sauce that you're thickening or to your soup that you're thickening, it's going to bring some starch along, right? And starch will act as a thickener. But a lot of the starch is already cooked during the bread-making process, so it's not going to be as powerful as a raw starch. But also, too, there is some substance to the bread. And this is a great way to use some leftover sourdough bread or any sort of homemade bread that you cooked. And maybe it's been on your counter a couple of days and it's not really eating that fresh anymore, but it's still a good product. It's far from being spoiled. Cubing it up into bread cubes and throwing it in, and what happens is all that bread's going to soak up that flavor, and then you can either just serve it as is, almost sort of a rustic take on a bread soup, which will give some heartiness and some thickness to your soup, or you can hit it with a blender, either a stick blender or an immersion blender, and blending up that bread that's been soaked with that soup or with that liquid is going to give you another level of thickness. Now, the final thickener I want to talk about, or thickeners, or class of thickeners, are what are called food-grade gums. And these are just now making their way into home use, and they've been used predominantly in professional kitchens for about the last 5 to 10 years on a regular basis. I mean, there are some guys on the leading edge that have been using them a little bit longer. But these are great for thickening sauces for a couple of different reasons. Number one, and let's talk about the two that I really like, which is Ultratex 3, and they have a new version called Ultratex 8, which I've experimented with a little bit, and it's basically just a tapioca starch extract that swells in the presence of water. And there's also xanthan gum, which I use on a continual basis. It's a great emulsifier, but it's basically a polysaccharide used as a food additive and basically a modifier, right? And it is produced by a process involving fermentation of glucose and sucrose molecules by a special strain of bacteria. And the great thing about both these, about both Ultratex 3 and xanthan gum, is that they're, number one, they're very, very subtle to absolutely no flavor in any of them, right? So they're not going to add a flavor to your sauce like a flour or a starch or bread or even a puree would. It's going to allow you to take an actual liquid that's not thick enough to be a soup or a sauce and thicken it without adding any flavor. Now, another great aspect is both of these gums will thicken cold liquids, right? So a lot of the times if you're using cornstarch, arrowroot, regular flour, whatever it is, you have to actually bring that liquid to a boil or to a simmer first to realize that full thickening power of that starch. With xanthan gum and Ultratex 3, this isn't the case. So this is going to allow you, I mean, say you wanted to do a like a melon soup, right? This is an example from a dish that I ran a while ago. And it was a very simple dish. It was just a honeydew melon soup. The honeydews were at the peak of their season. And what I would do is I would make a little mint simple syrup, right? Because honeydew and mint go great together. And I would just juice a couple of honeydew melons. I'd add in enough of that simple syrup to bring out a little bit of a sweetness and give it that mint hint. And then I'd place this in a blender, and I would thicken it with a very small amount of xanthan gum, about, I don't know, less than 0.25% by the total weight, right? So a very, very small amount. I mean, we're talking, you know, if I'm going to thicken about 900 grams or 1,000 grams of this juice and simple syrup mixture, I'll maybe be using 2 to 3 grams of xanthan gum. So it's very, very powerful stuff, and you use it in such a small amount that the taste is imperceptible. And it's giving you just enough thickness to have that proper mouthfeel where it clings to a spoon. But the great thing is about this technique is I was able to thicken this fresh honeydew melon juice without ever having to apply heat to it, which is really, really cool. And before I discovered xanthan gum as a thickener, this dish would not have been possible, right? Because the juice itself is too thin to actually call a soup. So I'd have to either alter the flavor by adding in some sort of puree, which would mess up the mouthfeel and the texture, or I'd have to reduce it to concentrate the flavors. But once you cook the honeydew juice, it's going to reduce out that flavor and have a cooked flavor to it. And if you add in some starch, again, you're going to have to bring it to a boil for that starch to reach its full thickening power. But also, too, it's gonna, that starch has its own distinct flavor that's going to impart on the honeydew. So for me, it was a really good way to sort of jump over that hurdle, right? And xanthan gum made that possible. Now, both xanthan gum and Ultratex 3 are what are called hydrocolloids, which interact and trap water. And, you know, people are like, ooh, xanthan gum, Ultratex 3, you know, you're putting all these chemicals. You know, no, it's not, you can't think of it like that because it's not true. Just because they're names that you don't understand or aren't readily available. You know, and gelatin, right? You know, the gelatin you make to use jello pudding pops. You know, that's a hydrocolloid, right? Because it interacts and it traps water. Okay, cornstarch, that's a hydrocolloid, right? Because it interacts with and it traps water. That's how it actually thickens the sauce. So the fact that you have at your disposal now these very, very refined food-grade gums that you can add at such low amount by a weight ratio and get this beautiful finished texture, it's really just another tool in your back pocket that you can use to open up new doors to new dishes and new techniques. All All right, so in today's technique segment, we're going to talk about Escoffier's version of sauce tomate and then talk about some other variations on the sauce that we call tomato sauce. Everyone's had tomato sauce, whether it's been out of a jar or a can or your grandmother made it or you had it at a restaurant. And so you understand that the tomato sauce has so many different crazy variations, and it all falls under this one big category labeled tomato sauce. Right, but it is one of the five French mother sauces, and Escoffier did have his own take on it. So my whole thing is, anything with cooking, is I'm all about breaking the rules, right, and trying new things, and, you know, just because it's classic and that's how it's been done for years doesn't mean this is the way you have to do it. But my rule for breaking rules is you first have to know the rules before you break them. Does that make sense? Right, so if you're going to do things that fly in the face of classical cooking, which is absolutely fine, and I'm all for, at least understand what it is that you're flying in the face of. And that's really what this lesson is about Escoffier's classic sauce tomate, which I would never really make unless I was doing an actual demonstration on it, because I think there's better and simpler ways to make tomato sauce. All right, but here's how it goes. One of the large differentiating factors between classical tomato sauce, as far as French cuisine is concerned, and modern versions, is Escoffier's use of white veal stock and a roux to thicken. Right, and so this sort of Escoffier's recipe is going to yield about 2 quarts of sauce. And so what he does is he starts with 2 to 3 ounces of salt pork, which is just like bacon, right? It comes from the belly region, and sometimes you'll find it comes from the back fat portion of the pig. And it's salted and cured just like bacon, except it's not smoked, which is going to give you the ability to cook with it and use it as an ingredient to impart fat and flavor without importing an actual smokiness to your sauce. And this is how Escoffier starts off his sauce tomate. He's basically going to render down the salt pork that he dices up to add some flavor and also to use as a cooking fat. Now, the best way, in my opinion, to render down some fat, especially if you're doing salt pork, which is pretty much pure fat, is place it over medium to medium-low heat in a very large or heavy bottom is more accurate. You want just a nice, thick, heavy bottom pan, which is going to help preventing it from scorching. And then add in a tablespoon or two of water, and that water is going to evaporate and steam as the pan heats up. And that steam is going to initially release out some of the fat within the salt pork, and then it'll allow it to kind of render and cook in its own fat. And during the rendering down process, is going to, you know, shrink and shrink and shrink, just like cooking bacon, and produce more fat for you to cook with. Now, once you've rendered down that salt pork, Escoffier's recipe calls for some mirepoix and some butter to be added into sweat. And so basically, you're just going to do, you know, a few ounces or just a handful of mirepoix, you know, carrot, celery, onions. And you're just going to do a small dice because this is actually going to be a part of the sauce and a part of the simmering process. And you're going to render that down. And then he's using the Farinier technique. So what's happening is he's going to be building a roux on top of the sweating mirepoix, right? So you have your pork fat in there, which is never a bad thing. You have butter in there, which is never a bad thing. And then you have mirepoix, which is sweating around and getting all happy in the butter and the pork fat. So on top of that, you're going to sprinkle in a few ounces of flour, and you're going to cook that together. It's going to come together, and you're going to start to smell the flour and the aromas of the mirepoix, and the flour is going to start to cook a little bit, and so you're going to start to get that nutty aroma. And that's kind of what you're looking for. And this, by the way, this technique of Farinier, which we talked about in the discussion segment, can be used like this with starting any sort of vegetable-based soup. You start by sweating down your mirepoix, or whatever aromatics you want in there. You dust with a little bit of flour, you cook the flour a little bit, and you start building your liquid base on top of that. Now, to this, he's going to add 5 pounds of raw tomatoes, unpeeled, he just throws them right in, about a quart of white stock, 1 clove of crushed garlic, salt and pepper to taste, and a little tiny pinch of sugar just to kind of counterbalance the acidity of the tomatoes. Now, once your sauce is actually put together and you have all the ingredients into your pot, Escoffier actually recommends cooking it in your oven. So, you know, if you build this into a cast iron Dutch oven or just, you know, some sort of cast iron pot that's oven safe that fits in your pot, you can do this. And he calls for moderate heat for a couple of hours. and you're going to cook it in the moderate heat is about, you know, 350 degrees Fahrenheit or 175 degrees Celsius. And basically, you're just slow cooking it so it all comes together. All the different flavors get to know each other. The sauce thickens slightly from the blanc roux that you basically built by sweating those vegetables and tossing in the flour using that farinier technique. And you can very much easily accomplish this on your stovetop, too, just by bringing it to a simmer, kind of simmering for about an hour, hour and a half, until everything kind of gets to know each other and the sauce thickens slightly. Now, being the typical masochistic French guy that Escoffier was, and the fact that they didn't have blenders in that day, he then tells you to take the whole thing and pass it through a sieve, right, which is a tamis, or a fine mesh screen. And so, you know, that's what you had your apprentices for back then, is because once the sauce got cooked, you just have some poor schlup just passing that stuff through a sieve all day long. Now, another option, too, is you can puree it in a blender, right? And it's like, I can hear the Italian screaming at me, no, no, not the blender. You know, we'll talk about that. But if you want a smooth final consistency, you can puree this sauce in a blender. Because remember, this is the French Escoffier way of doing it. Right, so you have the mirepoix and all that stuff then that you got to deal with. So you can blend it, and it's going to give you a smooth texture. Right, you're going to pass it through a chinois or fine mesh strainer, and it's going to give you that smooth tomato sauce. Now, the problem, though, with using a food processor or a blender to puree this is when you're blending a tomato sauce, any sort of tomato sauce, what happens is you have that beautiful, you know, dark red to bright red color. And during the blending process, it incorporates a bunch of air into the sauce, which isn't necessarily going to affect the flavor, but it turns it from a bright red to a bright pink. And pink isn't a very appetizing color. And, I mean, there are a couple of ways to get around this. Number one, if you let it sit in the refrigerator overnight, a lot of those air bubbles are going to naturally escape, and you'll notice that the next day you'll have, you know, your sauce will be a little bit darker in color. Another way, too, is if you happen to have a chamber vacuum sealer, which only costs about, you know, $3,000-$4,000 brand new, you could basically place your sauce in a shallow, wide pan that fits into your chamber vacuum sealer, close it, vacuum it on high, and the chamber is going to basically pull out all the oxygen that's within the sauce, and it's going to bring your color right back. So in that case, if you actually have a blender and a chamber vacuum sealer, you can blend it and then chamber vacuum seal it, and no one would be the wiser. But this is just to show you, you know, the classic French way of making sauce tomate, but also the mindset too, okay? Because this is before the advent of modern cuisine, before the whole haute cuisine revolution, where things got lighter and they got more flavorful. They were cooked quickly instead of over long periods of time. And this is just, you know, generalizations. But it's important to understand the framework that was laid and the foundation that was laid in French cuisine that later evolved into the different kinds of cuisines that we have today. And I'm not saying French cuisine is the only cuisine. I'm just saying that people who are classically trained and who, you know, kind of came up in that way and came up in that kitchen and who have evolved cuisine today, they were heavily influenced usually in one way or another by French cuisine. Right, unless they were completely Italian or they were completely, you know, studying a different sort of Asian cuisine. So you look at sauce tomate as an example of this, and it's, you know, good amount of fat, good amount of flour, browned in, farinier, very classic, adding in the veal stock, very classic, cooking in an oven, very classic, and then you want that nice smooth texture, which is a little more luxurious than a chunky texture. And so they have, you know, some poor schlup pass it through it to me, which is nothing wrong with that. It's just a pain. Now, for me, right, I like a simple tomato sauce, right? I like to actually showcase the flavor of the tomatoes. And there's a couple of different ways of doing this. The best way for me personally is, you know, I found at the restaurant I started making these Neapolitan style pizzas, right? And there's one of the things about a Neapolitan style pizza is you have to actually, you know, follow all these different rules. You gotta burn your wood at a certain temp, and you have to use oak, and you know, you have to, your pizzas have to cook within 60 to 90 seconds, and you know, all these different regulations, right? That if it's not done this way, it's not a Neapolitan style pizza, which was cool for me because it was a really big challenge, right? You know, cooking a pizza at 800 plus degrees Fahrenheit and you know, opening the dough properly. Anyways, I digress. But because of this evolution, one of the things that they call for is you have to use a raw tomato sauce made from San Marzano tomatoes, right? Which are basically plum tomatoes imported from Italy. And so the way that I would make this sauce is I would, you know, you would get these San Marzano tomatoes, and they were packed in their own juice, and I would pass them through a strainer just to separate the juice from the actual tomatoes themselves. And then I would grind these tomatoes through a food mill right on the medium die. And this was allowing me to basically make a puree with them without blending them up in the blender, which would incorporate in too much air and make my sauce pink. But what I was left with was this San Marzano tomato juice, right? Which was very, very flavorful. It just had this beautiful, bright, sunshine tomato flavor. And you can get the same quality canned plum tomatoes from California, too, if you live on the West Coast, which I do. I actually imported them from Italy just so I could see the difference. And don't tell my Italian friends. But now I just get my San Marzano-style tomatoes from California. It's you know, from a farm about 100 miles down the road from me. And, you know, suffice to say, we grow pretty damn good tomatoes in California. So anyway, and they're, you know, they're going to talk, oh, volcanic ash and yada, 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 and this and that and the other. And hey, there's nothing wrong with that, you know. Be a proud Italian. Be proud of your heritage. But I'm a California boy, so I'm going to use California plum tomatoes. So anyways, I'm left over with this beautiful, bright juice, right? And so we started using this in our hand-rolled pasta. Every single day, we make fresh hand-rolled pasta at the restaurant, and it's something that we feature on the menu. Usually, you know, it's a nice, light vegetarian option. And what we found is our favorite way to actually make a tomato sauce is by using the San Marzano jus. And the way that we would do this, right, is all you got to do is get out a saute pan, right? You got your fresh pasta kind of hanging out, ready to be cooked, hasn't been cooked yet. And in the saute pan, you're going to saute up whatever you want. You know, so in this case, we're going to throw in a little bit of shallots, maybe a little fresh chopped garlic. Let's do some nice wild mushrooms, whatever. You're going to toss around, saute, kind of let those flavors get to know each other. Throw a little bit of salt and pepper, maybe deglaze with a little bit of white wine, right? So that's going to be your base. Next, you're going to drop your pasta into your boiling pasta pot and your pasta water. And that pasta water gets nice and starchy throughout the night. And that's also going to help thicken our sauce a little bit. So, you know, after about 2 minutes tops, because the pasta is fresh, going to pull that bad boy out of the pasta water, drop it into the saute pan, you know, that we already have the base flavors in with the, you know, the white wine and the garlic and the mushrooms, all that good stuff. Toss it around a little bit, little tiny ladleful, and when I say ladleful, not really even a ladleful, maybe like, you know, an ounce of the pasta water, just boom, into the pot or into the pan with the pasta mixture, then about a 2 ounce shot of this San Marzano jus right at the end, boom, 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 flip, 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 adding a little bit of a fresh chopped basil or whatever fresh herb you got lying around, and because that tomato sauce or the tomato juice wasn't cooked and simmered forever, you still have that nice, bright flavor of the raw, fresh tomato, and it really comes through on that pasta, whereas an escoffier-style tomato sauce that's been simmered for hours, then passed through a tamis, and is, you know, basically a thick puree tomato sauce, it's going to be really, really heavy, and it's going to weigh down that fresh pasta, which is going to defeat the whole purpose of making a nice, light, delicate, fresh pasta in the first place. So that's just to show you basically the two ends of the spectrum for making a good tomato sauce. Now, there are some modern variations on the escoffier sauce tomate. And again, this isn't really how the Italians would make it. Well, you know what? Let's digress for a second. Let's actually talk about how the Italians would make it. Tomato sauce is a simple art form that is to be mastered by any Italian cook. And the simpler, the better. Usually what they do is they start by scoring, blanching, and peeling their tomatoes. And they hand squeeze out the seeds, and they're just left with the tomato flesh. To this, they usually, in a bottom of a pot, they'll usually sweat down a little bit of garlic. They always start with good olive oil that has a nice flavor. A little bit of garlic, add the tomatoes, little bit of basil right at the end. You know, you never want to add your fresh herbs too early on, and they'll add it right at the end, maybe chopped, maybe chiffonade, who knows, you know, it all depends. A little bit of salt for seasoning, and then they're going to hand crush it with one of those, you know, basically what we know as a potato masher, right? And they're going to hand crush it. Sometimes they'll pass it through a sieve, But that's it. That's tomato sauce in an Italian kitchen. Now, sometimes they'll add a little bit of oregano, basil, depending upon the region, the style, what their personal preference is. But the simpler, the better. Right now, I'm a big proponent of saying that complexity hides flaws. Well, nothing is more true than when tasting a true Italian chef's tomato sauce. It is simple, clean, and beautiful. And don't let its simplicity fool you. It's extremely hard to make. That's why so many other people, they add so much stuff for their tomato sauce, because a true, purely clean tomato sauce is hard and difficult to make. But that's besides the point. Because that doesn't mean that these tomato sauces that have a bunch of ingredients in them, that they taste bad or that there's something wrong with them. They're just not the simple tomato sauce that you would find in Italy. Now, one of the modern variations on a Scoffier's tomato sauce is basically, instead of using fresh tomatoes, they use a 2-to-1 mix of canned tomatoes and tomato puree or juice. And instead of using white veal stock, which is basically useless in my opinion, they're going to get a ham bone. They're going to simmer that ham bone and basically a couple of pork bones thrown in there. And they're basically making a stock with the tomato, the canned tomatoes, the canned tomato puree and the tomato juice, maybe a little bit of water. And to this, they'll tend to add some fresh herbs, some bay leaf, thyme, rosemary, basil. Now, these can be all added at your discretion. If using fresh herbs, you always want to add right at the end of the cooking process, about 5 to 10 minutes before you're actually ready to serve. But if using dry herbs, they can be added at the beginning of the cooking process, and they should, because dry herbs are only good for long, drawn-out cooking processes. Now, lots of people like to bag on dry herbs, but they do have their place in cooking, especially if they, haven't been in your pantry for years on end. I mean, if the dry herbs are fairly fresh, they can bring a lot to the party. But the key is, the rule of thumb is, dried herbs are reserved for long cooking processes, such as simmering a tomato sauce over a couple of hours. However, you will always, always, always find a good advantage to adding fresh herbs for that final kick right at the end. Although it makes no sense to add fresh herbs to your sauce at the beginning, because you're just going to cook out all those flavors. They're going to turn a drab, ugly green. It's not good. Remember how we were talking in our blanching episode? Remember we were talking about chlorophyll molecules and how they break down and extend a period of time and a certain temperature, the chlorophyllase enzyme starts kicking in, blah, 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 blah. Well, bottom line, you know, most of your herbs, you know, are green herbs, right? Which means they contain a ton of chlorophyll. Talking basil, oregano, marjoram, chives, all that stuff is going to break down during the long, drawn-out cooking process of your tomato sauce. So reserve those for the end. And my personal preference is, a lot of times, not even to put in the fresh herbs into the sauce. Maybe just do a nice fine chiffonade and sprinkle that chiffonade over the top as a garnish. And if you're unfamiliar with the chiffonade technique, we do have a video in our whole knife skill series, so you can check that out. Now, here's the thing. I'm all for fresh and simple and great technique and all that stuff, but sometimes you're just in a pinch, right? Sometimes you just need a good, fast tomato sauce, and you don't want to spend your entire Saturday peeling, you know, a case of plum tomatoes or a case of Romas and mashing it up and doing the whole Italian grandmother thing. You know, I feel you. You got to take your kids to soccer practice or go watch their baseball games or whatever it is that you got to do on your day off. And you know, you want to have a nice dinner. Maybe you want to do a nice fresh pasta with homemade tomato sauce. But you don't want to turn it into a 5-hour process. So in a pinch, I always keep at home a couple cans of tomato paste. I know, like, I can hear you guys gasping. Hey, but there's nothing wrong with tomato paste. All right, if used properly, there's nothing wrong. You just got to understand it for what it is, okay? And here's the thing with tomato paste, right? What happens is, when they go out and they pick all the tomatoes that you're buying at your supermarket are actually green when they're picked. They're unripe. That's why they always taste like nothing, right? Even the vine-ripe tomatoes, quote-unquote vine-ripe, what that literally means is they cut the tomatoes that are green, still attached to the vine, and they just ship them with the vine on. And they ripen them by gassing them with ethylene gas. Okay, that's forced ripening. The ethylene gas is gas. It force ripens the fruit. It turns from green to red. bada bing. Because the reason is a true beautiful tomato that's ripened on the vine is a pain in the butt to ship. You've seen those big tomato trucks rolling down the highway, right? That's tons and tons and tons of tomatoes in that truck. The ones on the bottom are for sure going to get smashed into nothing, right? So actually what happens is the ones that do ripen on the vine, that are ripe, they take those, they cook them down, and they turn them into tomato paste or canned tomatoes, or God forbid they end up and they become ketchup. What a horrible, horrible fate for a beautiful tomato. But regardless, you have a nice, fresh, concentrated flavor, and then it gets cooked down during some of the cooking process, some of the tomato flavor is lost. But tomato paste does have its place, right? And you can doctor it. That's the whole purpose, right? We're not going to try and recreate a fresh, from scratch, Italian grandmother's recipe for tomato sauce because it's too time-consuming on your Saturday, on your night off, right? So the basic ratio that you need to remember is for every one can of tomato paste, you need 3 parts of water. Now, if you got some chicken stock hanging out, even if you have some chicken, you know, that nice organic chicken stock that they sell, it comes in the cardboard box, that stuff's good in a pinch. Don't worry about that, all right? Because again, you're just doctoring, all right? If you have the homemade chicken stock that you learned how to make in episode 3, beautiful, use it. It's going to be even better. But if not, use a little water, use a little bit of the store-bought stuff. You just make sure that it's the organic stuff that doesn't have, you know, a bunch of preservatives in it, because it just doesn't taste that good. And to that, you're going to add whatever you want. I like to add caramelized onions, possibly some roasted garlic, possibly, you know, a pinch of dried oregano, pinch of dried basil, maybe a little bit of red chili flake. And you can go from there. Some people like to throw in some andouille sausage, a little bit of lemon zest, you know, a good little shot of red wine. I prefer not to add red wine into my tomato sauces because it means less for me to drink. So, you know, it's a personal opinion. And you're going to simmer that down. And it's all about, you know, so now you've taken the concept of a tomato sauce and you've turned it into a binding agent, right? You've turned it into a vehicle to, instead of in a true Italian tomato sauce, the star of the show is the tomatoes and the freshness and the delicacy of the sauce. Whereas now you've taken a tomato sauce, you've kind of bastardized it, which there's nothing wrong with that. Just understand what you're doing. And you're using it as a vehicle to show off some nice roasted caramelized onions, some nice fresh herbs from the back of your garden, some nice andouille sausage that was handmade and you picked up from the local supermarket. So that's another way to approach tomato sauce. And there's no right or wrong in cooking, okay? I mean, there's good technique and there's bad technique. And there's being educated and there's being ignorant. Now, as long as you're educated on the good technique and the proper way of doing stuff, then, you know, go for it. It's your day off. You know, you don't want to peel a bunch of plum tomatoes on your day off, really? Come on. You know, if you want to do that, come to my kitchen. I'll put you to work. You make you an apprentice. All right, so in today's Q&A, I got a couple of questions to answer. First one comes from Luke, and this one's a little bit involved, so get ready for a tad bit of geek speak. I mean, you know how I get sometimes. So, hold on. I'm sorry. I got to pull this up. You'd think I'd be on top of this stuff. Okay, so Luke says this, right? He's talking about baking cookies, all right? And so basically Luke's question is, the cookie sets because the egg cooks, right? Cookies use sodium bicarbonate in one form or another for leavening, adding a base, you know, base as an alkaline substance like sodium bicarbonate, must have some impact on the way in which the cookie cooks. I did a bit of experimenting. The CO2 was an overwhelming variable, so I used baking soda. It seems baking soda, not surprisingly, in the absence of a real acid, adds very little puff. But it does have a real effect. At 375 degrees, it's going to set regardless, but I think the speed at which it does so and resulting cookie change with the different amounts of sodium bicarbonate. The base seems to slow the setting of the cookie. I made a disgusting paper thin mess at one point. My theory is that adding a base slows the cooking process, letting the butter melt and the cookie run all over the place. With enough base, the repellent molecules denature at such a distance from one another that they are unable to establish a useful protein network. This creates a nasty non-cookie thing. In moderation, I can generate a less structurally sound cookie, i.e. soft and chewy. And this was the crux of his whole question, is sort of messing with the formula to get a chewy cookie. Is any of my explanation or observation correct? My final question from this epic afternoon adventure. Box chocolate chip cookies are generally rock hard. However, some brands make an always soft version that has an unnatural Play-Doh-like texture. Is this accomplished with pH or another technique? Thanks, Luke. All right, so basically what happened is Luke was getting all geeky in his kitchen. He was testing things out, and he has, you know, obviously a bit of a scientific background. And he was trying to play with the science and the different reactions within the cookie to make a nice chewy cookie, which some people really, really like. So first, sodium bicarbonate, also known as baking soda, is a leavening agent that acts in the presence of an acid. What Luke is talking about is adding a base to the cookie dough to raise the pH, making the cookie dough less acidic and retarding some of the baking soda's leavening power. Now, real quick, the difference between baking soda and baking powder is that baking powder is a complete self-contained leavening system. It contains both alkaline baking soda and a crystallized acid. When mixed with a dough and heated, the acid dissolves, activating the baking soda. Most home versions of baking powder are what's called double acting, meaning that some of the acid crystals dissolve and activate the sodium bicarbonate when first mixed into the batter, and then when heated or baked, they release another set of acid that activates the rest of the sodium bicarbonate. So as you can see, just the example of a double-acting baking soda suggests that you can control the effects of pure baking soda on your cookie just by making them less acidic or by controlling the release of acid. However, if it's just purely a chewy cookie that you're after, I think there's an easier way to go about it, right? First of all, eggs are added to cookie dough recipe for structure, right? Normally with breads, you'll knead the dough for an extended period of time to form a complex gluten network. And this is what gives your bread both structure and also allows it to rise by trapping the gases released by the leavening agent, usually yeast. Since you want a cookie to have a tender texture, the dough is mixed just enough to bring all the ingredients together. The egg is added to aid with the structure of the cookie itself and allow it to set. But really the biggest difference or the biggest effect on the chewiness or crispiness of your cookie comes from the type of sweetener or sugar that you use. Regular table sugar, which is also known as sucrose, according to Harold McGee, competes with the flour of starch for water and raises the starch gelation temperature nearly to the boiling point. So it adds hardness and crispness because you got to cook the cookie longer for it to gel properly. But sucrose also adds another dimension to your cookie. Since the addition of sucrose allows you to raise the gelation temperature of the flour, then the dough itself is allowed to become hotter than if there were no sugar at all. What happens then is that the dough is able to dissolve and turn into a liquid and spread throughout your cookie, including the sugar that's included within your batter. As anyone who's ever made a hard candy or a caramel knows, that when you melt sugar and allow it to cool, it becomes extremely crisp. This is what happens when you use regular sucrose or table sugar in your cookies. So a couple of things to play around with. Number one, try using a little bit of corn syrup or molasses instead of regular table sugar. Both have a way of absorbing water and both stay relatively fluid, i.e. they don't crystallize, at room temperature. Now number two, the addition of corn syrup will also make your cookie spread more when it heats up in the oven, giving you a thinner cookie. So to counteract this, first chill your cookie dough before putting it on your baking sheet, and more important, use lard or margarine for your fat, both of which have a higher melting temperature than that of butter, so that's not going to spread out as readily during the cooking process. And sometimes the best way to research these kinds of things is to leverage the multi-million dollar R&D budgets of commercial food companies. So for example, when I received your email, I took a little field trip to the cookie aisle of my local supermarket, picked up a couple of chewy cookie brands, and read their labels. Sure enough, all of them had two things in common. For their fat, they use partially hydrogenated oil, which is basically food science speak for margarine, and high fructose corn syrup for their sweetening agent. So in short, when it comes to the question of a cookie texture, sodium bicarbonate definitely does play a role, but to control the crispiness and chewiness of your cookie, I would experiment, number one, with the kinds of sweetening agents that you use, and number two, the kinds of fats that you incorporate. Thanks again for the great question. I appreciate it, Luke. Now, our next question comes from Joey, and he says, short and sweet, my wife has a huge Corian cutting board she just gave me. However, I am terrified that this will ruin my nice chef's knives. They seem just as hard as glass, and I'm afraid to use them. Any thoughts would be appreciated. Best, Joey. Well, yes, Joey, in short, be afraid. Be very, very afraid. Don't use Corian with your nice chef's knife. For home use, I always recommend wood. Okay, wood is has a nice, fast chopping surface. It's nice and hard. You just need to understand the proper cleaning and caring for your wood cutting board, which basically means you always need to be able to, you know, have a bench scraper to scrape off any gunk. You want to scrub it really good with a steel scrubby, some hot soapy water, scrape it off again, and you're going to also use a mild bleach solution to sanitize and to finish using your wood chopping board. Also, too, I would recommend, if you don't want to go the wood route, go to your local restaurant supply store and just pick up their nice large plastic cutting boards that they have. And they're really not that expensive. If you go to one of the designer kitchen stores, they carry them as well, but they're going to charge you a lot more money for them because that's what they do. They're designer kitchen stores, not restaurant supply stores. So you can go and pick up a nice cheap cutting board. Bottom line, though, you want a cutting surface that is hard enough to make your knife movements nice and fast and to make your knife responsive, but soft enough to absorb your blade and to let your knife slightly, ever so slightly, cut into it. Because if your cutting board is too hard, or if, God forbid, it's the same hardness as your knife, then every time your knife blade hits that, it's going to get more and more dull. So that'd be my recommendation. I recommend against Corian. Number one, I go definitely go with wood. And then number two, if you don't want to go with wood, I would go with a nice high food grade plastic cutting board, or a nice rubber cutting board, both of which can be found at your local restaurant supplies. All right, so before we go today, in today's culinary quick tip, I figure, hey, you know, why not talk real quick about fresh homemade pasta? Because it's really not that difficult. I mean, it is an art form unto itself. But the basics are fairly simple. I'm just going to give you a couple of basic tips and a basic recipe to sort of get the ball rolling, right? And eventually I'm going to shoot a video on this, and we'll even get into some different types of pasta that you can make at home. But really what you're going to use is just either semolina flour, which is traditional, and you want to get the double lot semolina pasta flour because it's going to be a lot easier to work with. Or in a pinch, you can use all-purpose flour or bread flour. Now, both all-purpose flour and bread flour, they're still going to make a great pasta. The semolina is a little bit more traditional. It's going to give you a little bit of a better texture, in my opinion, but it's not wholly necessary. Okay, so if you have some all-purpose flour laying around, you can use that. Now, you're going to start with 1 pound or 450 grams of your flour, whether semolina or AP bread flour. And yes, I do expect you to weigh these. Okay, now as this podcast moves on, no complaining, all right? A nice digital scale, you can get I use an Escali. In my professional kitchen, I use an Escali, and we beat the hell out of it, and they last me about possibly a year to 2 years, all right? And this is using it like for almost every single recipe we make on a daily basis, okay? So they're pretty rugged if they can take a beating from us for about a year, year and a half, and still keep ticking. $20 to $30 for an Escali scale that's digital, that weighs both in grams and ounces. And as this podcast moves forward, as Stella Culinary moves forward as an instructional site, a lot of the recipes are going to be in weight measurements, whether ounces or grams, because that's the only way to really accurately replicate a recipe, right? I mean, the whole purpose of the site is to teach you how to cook like a professional chef. So in my kitchen, if you want to replicate one of our recipes, you grab a scale and you follow the recipe and you follow it to the gram. All right. It's not like a dash of this and a pinch of that, a hint of that. It's not set up to be a recipe site. So, you know, I'm just digressing. I'm trying not to get on your case too much. But if you're serious about cooking, you're not going to try and saute without a saute pan, right? Why would you try and follow a recipe without a scale? That's how important it is. And for $20 to $30, they're not even that expensive. So, anyways, go and buy a digital scale. And then if you want to make this pasta, you're going to weigh out 450 grams of your flour, which is, you know, relevant to about a pound. Okay. Now, to this, you're going to add 5 eggs. And you're going to make, you're going to take your flour, basically, and you're going to put it on your cutting board, your work surface, and you're going to make a little, like, a volcano with it. And you're going to crack your eggs right into the center of this volcano. You're going to take a fork, you're going to beat these eggs around, and as you're moving them around, you're going to take the outer edge of flour and gently push it into your egg mixture and keep on pushing it until it starts to form a paste. And once it forms a paste, you're going to hit it with a little bit of salt, just a little sprinkle of salt, you know, like a 1-2 finger pinch or 1 or 2 grams, and a 1/2 ounce of good olive oil. And then you're going to take this paste, you're going to mix it with the rest of your flour, you're going to start to knead it, and you're going to hand knead it for a little bit just to bring it together. And it's not really important to really hand knead it too much. Number one, because it's going to be a really stiff dough if it's made properly. So it's going to be really difficult to hand knead. And number two, we're going to knead it during the rolling process later. So what you want to do is you want to knead it just long enough to bring that dough together, and you're going to wrap it in plastic wrap, and you're going to place it in your refrigerator for about, at minimum, a 1/2 hour, but possibly an hour, hour and a half. This is going to allow the gluten to relax and for the dough to hydrate properly. Next, after that resting period, you're going to pull it out, you're going to set up your pasta roller or your pasta machine. Now, the old Italian grandmothers, they've done this with rolling pins, which is absolutely amazing to me, because I've attempted it twice with a rolling pin, just because I'm like, if an Italian grandmother can do it, I can do it, you know, what the hell? No, not true. These people are damn superheroes in my book, okay? Honestly, rolling out pasta with a rolling pin is a superhuman feat, all right? Which is not to be attempted by the faint of heart. I'm a pretty strong guy, and I was exhausted, and my pasta came out horrible. So you can get the hand crank version of a pasta roller. They run about $40 or $50, and they clamp to the side of your work surface or your table. For something a little bit more convenient but more spendy, you can go and get the attachment for your stand mixer, and you know it attaches right to your stand mixer, and it's, you know, it's driven by the motor, so you don't have to hand crank it. But I mean, these things can cost a couple $100 depending upon what kind of stand mixer you have. But regardless, either way, you're going to set your pasta roller, your pasta machine, on the thickest setting, and you're going to cut off a small hunk, probably about a quarter of this dough. You're going to flatten it out with your hand or maybe a rolling pin, just enough to where it'll go through the rollers on the pasta machine. And you're going to roll it through. You're going to roll it through that thickest setting, and it's going to come out in a little bit of a longer sheet. You're going to take that sheet, you're going to fold it back on top of itself, you're going to pass it back through your pasta maker, and then once it gets to the width of your actual rollers, you're going to fold that sheet horizontally, or excuse me, you're going to actually fold it lengthwise. So now it's half as wide as it was before, and you're going to pass it through those largest rollers again. You want to continue this kneading process of folding the dough in half and passing it through your largest rollers about 13 to 15 times, okay? And this is going to knead the dough. It's going to help form that gluten structure. That's really important. And you'll know when you're finished, or you know when you're ready to move on, because the dough will start to look almost, you know, it'll look smooth, satiny, almost shiny, and it'll have a little bit of a bounce to it, just a slight bounce. At this point, you start cranking it down, right? So you'll take it, and usually there's numbers, and they go up to like either 6 or 8, depending upon the kind of machine that you have. And so the largest roller is usually set at 0, and then you're going to put it to number 1. Right, and that's going to be the next thinnest layer. Right, the number 2, the number 3, and each time you're going to pass it through 1 or 2 times, and the dough is going to get thinner. It's going to get longer. It's going to stretch out more. At about number 6 to number 8 setting is time to start thinking about cutting your pasta. And either you can cut it into fettuccine or tagliatelle, and sometimes these cutting connections are actually shipped with the roller themselves. Sometimes you have to actually go out and buy them separately. And sometimes you want to leave the sheet whole in the case of, you know, using it for a ravioli. If you're going to make raviolis, you want the nice whole sheet so you can make your filling. For us personally, what I like to do is I like to roll the sheet out for our hand-rolled pasta. We roll it out to, I don't know, about the number 7 setting. And then we cut it into lengths about a foot long. And we're going to dust each length with a nice little dose of semolina flour to keep them from sticking. And we stack these lengths on top of one another. From there, we just take and we simply roll them up together. And then we cross cut them into our pasta strips. And we usually cross cut them about a half an inch to 3/4 inch thick. Now, this hand cutting does a couple of things. Number one, it gives you a little bit wider, or actually 2 to 3 times wider than the normal fettuccine pasta. And I think it really kind of shows off the nice fresh texture of the pasta because you're getting more for the bite. But also, too, it kind of gives it that rustic homemade look, which I want. You know, we work really hard on making that pasta from hand, from scratch every day. And so I want it to look like it's homemade. I don't want it to look like it's machine manufactured. And cross-cutting it by hand with your knife gives you control over the width of your noodle and also just kind of gives it that nice homey look. From there, you're going to take your noodles that have been cut. You're going to toss them a little bit more semolina. And you're going to put them on a sheet tray and wrap it loosely with plastic wrap. And this is going to keep your noodles from drying out. And you can hold them like this at room temperature for a few hours. From there, it's just a simple boiling and draining process. Okay, a couple of rules for that, though, is number one, you always want to bring your water to a rolling boil, and you always want to use a good amount of water. Okay, you just use a big pot of water. You want the noodles to be able to move around and not stick to one another. Add in enough salt to make your pasta water taste like seawater. Okay, you want it nice and salty. This is going to be your last chance to actually season those noodles while they cook. Number three, colanders are evil. Shame on you, bad, evil colander. Okay, don't ever use a colander. You want to use a spider, which is like one of those little strainers to go out and fish your noodles. Tongs, and be very, very gentle if you're fishing out with your noodles out with tongs. Or you want to use an actual pasta pot with a pasta basket, and that's best case scenario. Because what happens is the pasta cooking process is, like we talked about earlier, is the first step. The second step is the sauce, it which goes into your saucepan with whatever sauce that you're using. Okay, if you pass your pasta through a colander, all of that starch is rinsing off of that pasta, and God forbid you toss it with olive oil or butter, or you rinse it in cold water to stop the cooking process. Oh my Lord, shame on you. Because the starch is going to help the sauce cling to the pasta itself. And what happens, though, too, is during the sauce-making process, when you're coating your pasta with that sauce, if you need a little extra hit of starch, right, to help, that final little push to thicken your sauce, you can take that from your pasta cooking water. So anyways, that's how you cook fresh pasta. There will be a video eventually, but that should get the ball rolling. And have fun with your newly found sauce tomate and pasta making skills. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School process. When you're coating your pasta with that sauce, if you need a little extra hit of starch, right, to help, that final little push to thicken your sauce, you can take that from your pasta cooking water. So anyways, that's how you cook fresh pasta. There will be a video eventually, but that should get the ball rolling. And have fun with your newly found sauce tomate and pasta making skills. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thanks so much for joining me. And make sure you tune in next episode. We're going to be finishing our 5-part series on the French mother sauces, talking about the Mac Daddy of all, sauce espagnole, which is the basis for